saving money when you start your next project today at Menards. Check out our great selection of garage and utility lighting options. In stock, ready to take home today. We carry everything to help you illuminate whatever project you're working on. Shop garage and utility lighting products in store at your nearest Menards. You can also view all of our entire selection of lighting options today on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. I want to start off by thanking Elon Musk for undoing decades of myth building. Thank you, Elon, for proving to us that billionaires aren't all that bright. He paid $44 billion for a company that was worth $11 billion and is in the process of turning it into a $3 billion problem. Good. Nice job. Nice job. Almost Trumpian in its scale. Fortunately for him, and this is where, again, this is where the myth, this is where the rich people, they've figured the game out that they can fail upward. We learned a lot of that during the Bush years. Failing upward is something the wealthy do very, very well because they insulate themselves from risk. Having wealth and opportunity and connections insulates you from that kind of risk. So, of course, the rest of us are going to, well, pick up the tab because he'll be able to write it off. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. It'll go into the portfolio of other things and it'll offset any gains that they may have so that they can have smart pencil pushers, you know, just write that off for the next decade so you won't have any tax obligations. Yeah, great. Congratulations, Merca. Screwed again. And the reason I bring this up is because I hear this frame all the time. We need a businessman as president. That was the argument for Donald Trump, wasn't it? Smart guy, businessman, lucrative, makes good money, brilliant business, self-made businessman. Remember all that stuff? You know, never mind. The father gave him a whole bunch of money, built an empire, all the invisible capital that came along with being Fred Trump's son. Never. Don't look behind the curtain. But self-made man, billionaire, successful business person. Everyone was going on and on during his presidency about the tax returns. Now, I said from the beginning, and I go back to this and I stand by it, there's no smoking gun in the tax returns. There's embarrassment in the tax returns. That's the reason Trump is holding on so hard to it. If there were actual crimes in there, he would probably be okay with you knowing that because I do believe he wants you to know when he is criming and when he is getting away with it. But I said from the beginning, there's embarrassment in here because it's going to be proof that he's not that smart of a business guy, that he's not that rich. He's not fill in the blank. And I've said that from the beginning. The day it came out, the day they said he's not going to show his tax returns because, you know, whatever the BS reason that he blathered out. Well, we find out in testimony, an executive, a partner at Mazars USA LLP, which is the tax preparation firm that worked for the Trump organization. Now, don't get your panties all in a bunch here. Trump is not on trial. Trump is not going to jail for any tax stuff. This is the Trump organization. This is the business. And besides, they've already got Weaselberg, who has already fallen on the sword and said, no, it was all me. Donald Trump gave me total control of all of his businesses. Trump put all his faith in me and me alone to make all of these decisions about him and his family. And again, if you believe that, oh, I've got Brooklyn Bridges and Trump Towers I can sell you. But that's the official story of right now, that Weaselberg He is the lone gunman. He's the lone tax cheat here. But what we found out in the trial, in the testimony that happened today by this longtime accountant of the Trump Organization, is something we've known, already knew. This is nothing new. There's no, oh my gosh, no one knew. Everyone knew. Been saying this for years. Trump's not as rich as he says he is, and doesn't pay his taxes. And what they what came out in this testimony from 2009 to 2018, paid virtually no taxes. In fact, it had operating losses in every year, except one, I believe. And that was that year he paid $750. The year he became president. Yeah, $750 was the 2017. He paid $750 in 2017. $750. Now, this is a billionaire, mind you, billionaire, successful businessman, lots of business, lots of economic activity, lots of cash flow, lots of stuff. Ask yourself, how much did you pay in federal income tax last year, you working person? You person who makes people like Trump wildly wealthy. When you bought the red hat, did you pay tax on that? Yeah, of course you did. The question is, did he, according to the testimony from Mr. Bender today, the partner at Mazars USA, operating losses all these years. Now, you remember New York Times? They came out with a story, was it 2 years ago? That said over an 11-year span, over an 18-year span, 11 of the 18 years of the tax records they were looking at, he only paid taxes in one of those years, and that was 2017. Now, the amounts of the losses. Now, I understand, hey, I lost $5. I get that. 2009, he loses $700 million. 2010, he loses $200 million. Now again, I'm going, hold on, you know, this is supposed to be a smart businessman. And you go, but Rick, the smart businessmen know how to, you know, how to take on debt, so they avoid their tax. And look, there's some truth in this. There's some loopholes that corporations use that they lobby for that give them the opportunity to evade taxes. And there's part of this. In fact, he said, you know, Trump said during the debate with Hillary, him not paying taxes makes him smart. But the New York Times pointed out that, you know, in 1995, if you thought $700 million was a lot, in 1995, he had $915 million in losses. Now, this is a guy who, you know, basically bankrupted a casino, which, okay. Now, the reason I bring this up is because we're told that, you know, we need a businessman in the White House. Do we need this kind of businessman? I'm just, you know, Elon Musk, you know, we're told he's a genius. Really? I mean, can we start questioning this stuff now on a level that makes you go, really? Do we really need this kind of smart? Now, here's the interesting part of this. This is where corporate America has been getting away with this stuff for years. And the wealthy don't want you to know what they've been getting away with. And in this, we find out that, you know, the executives were given such perks as Manhattan apartments. They were given Mercedes-Benz cars, having the kids' private school tuition paid for out of the business accounts, pre-tax, of course. Don't have to pay any tax on this stuff. Completely under the radar. Who needs to know? Who needs to know? Yeah, you know, the IRS? Nah, they don't need to know. That taxes? That's for poor people. That's for those working stiffs. You know, the people who clean up after us? Yeah, that's what that is. That's the worldview that these folks have. That's the worldview that they have of the people wearing the red hats. And this is the part that, this is that moment where I go, you know, I see a working person with the regalia. They bought the hat, they got the t-shirt, you know, made in China, of course, they're flying the flag. They got the F. Biden shirt because, you know, Joe Biden doesn't care. They got all of it. They got the rhetoric. They're transferring from MAGA to MAGAGA. You know, they're making the transition. They're getting the new regalia. They're moving. And somehow, in their twisted belief structure, they think that this guy gives a rat's behind about them. A tinker's dam. No. What he cares about is himself. And this is the part where I hope this is why these trials are important. And maybe these trials where you go, maybe we should have 100 of these, 1,000 of them. Maybe every corporation that does this stuff, we should be dragging onto the rug. Now, I did allow myself about 20 minutes to fall into the rabbit hole known as the comment section. And what is interesting about the comment section is you got the polar opposite viewpoints. People who think that this is going to be Trump's undoing. It's not. He's not even on trial. And the people who think that Trump did nothing wrong. Absolutely nothing wrong. And by Weaselberg falling on the sword. Knowing what we know about Donald Trump, the kind of control freak mentality is, do you really buy? Really, do you buy? No, Weaselberg, you do it all. You know where all the money and the bodies are. You know where it's all at. You get the combination of the safe. No, don't give it to me. Why would I need such information? Yeah. Now, again, I come back to the tax returns, which the story today, again, oops, not a good day in court for Donald Trump because the Supreme Court, the Donald Trump Supreme Court, removed what is the last roadblock for the House Ways and Means Committee to finally obtain said tax returns. Now, understand, Trump's been fighting a subpoena since 2019. And I got to think he thought his Supreme Court, he thought, you know, Kavanaugh and Gorsuch and Amy Covid Barrett, he had to think they were going to come to his defense. Alito certainly would be there. Clarence Thomas certainly going to be there. No. no. They did not weigh in his favor. In fact, not a good day in court on multiple fronts. Also, the 11th Circuit heard the Justice Department argument on the special master that was appointed to review the government documents seized from the Golden Palace down in Mar-a-Lago. And they decided that, well, the special master was wrongly decided. So, oops, Donald's not going to be thrilled about that decision either. Now, all this while he's trying to run for president. And I, again, find it very interesting that more bad news for Donald. The American people, not overly thrilled. In fact, the latest Quinnipiac poll, a week after Trump announces his intentions to seek the nomination in 2024, they find 57% of Americans think it's a bad idea. 57. I'm going, wow, that's impressive. 37% think it's a good idea. Yeah, that's the base, right? Those are the people who are holding the country by the short and danglies. Yeah, that's where we are. Now the question is, will the others, the 57%+, will they save us in the future? That is the question. Love to hear your thoughts. 1-866-416-RICK. 1-866-416-7425. I got lots to get to today, lots to talk about. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, more of the fun from the House GOP clown show that is going to be. The circus shall begin. Quick break, right back. Stick around. Fan of the show, you've heard our Labor History in Two segments, and you can hear them on the radio pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Labor history has never been more important than it is right now. So here's what we'd like you to do. Tell a teacher that labor history is important and that they can get digestible 2-minute lessons that are absolutely free to download, free to use, free to share. Tell a teacher to go to thericksmithshow.com/history and help us put labor back where it belongs, in the classroom. You know, generations of American workers fought, bled, and died to build the American way of life. It's our job to keep their stories alive. Go tell a teacher that we're here to help them do just that. Find us at thericksmithshow.com/history today.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Kevin McCarthy doing everything he can do to muster up the votes to become speaker. He wants it bad. He wants it bad. And again, I come back to, as I said from the beginning, I want it for him. I do. I want him to be speaker. I want him to get what he wants. And I want him to get what he deserves. He deserves Marjorie Trainwreck Greene. He deserves Matt Gaetz. He deserves Louis Go-Go Gohmert. He deserves Gosar and the whole clown show that is going to be just, well, if nothing, entertaining, nauseating, angering. But, you know, Republican. He has today come out and called on the Homeland Security Secretary, Alejandro Mayorkas, to resign over the handling of the U.S.-Mexico border, because we got to double down on immigration, because we've got to go back to some fear. And he says if Secretary Mayorkas does not resign, House Republicans will investigate every order, every action, every failure, will determine whether we can begin impeachment. And you go, what do you mean? Why did you have all of those other words? Why not just say, we're going to impeach him? Because you know that's what you want to do. You know that's what you want to do. You got to have payback. And the I word, something that Democrats put on their tongue. They didn't know what it was before. Now they do. And they're going to use, it's the new hammer. It is going to be what they try and hit everything with. So are we surprised? No, we are not surprised. It's going to be interesting to see how far they go. How far are they willing to break precedent, to break law? How far are they willing to go to rig the game, to steal the future? I look at Ohio. Ohio with this, sorry, people, if you want to bring a ballot initiative, you have to have 60% of the vote to get it passed. But we in the legislature, we just need 50%. Yes. I now see this story coming out of Florida. Again, Republicans have no shame. They are now posed, according to both the House Speaker Paul Renner and the Senate President Kathleen Pasimodo, they were sworn into their post, and they both said it would be a good idea to clear the path for DeSantis to run for president. Now, in Florida, the thing is if you decide to run for president or run for something like that, you have to give up your office. You can't do both. So they're now going to go, we're going to change the law for Ron DeSantis. We're going to change it so that if he becomes the nominee, he can still be governor while running for president. And you go, do you expect anything less? Answer, no. And speaking of DeSantis, you remember the vote fraud police? Remember when they were going to get those vote fraud cops out on the road and they arrested like 20 people because he said they were illegally voting? You know, 20 of them. He got 20 of them from the entire 2020 election. 20 of them. Well, they lost one trial and they just dropped the charges against another one. I guess they didn't want to go to court and get slapped again. So this is where we're going to see this going, because, you know, the voter fraud that Republicans say is out there doesn't exist. Now, as I've been saying, the fraud that really is going on is the stuff that they pull right out in the light of day. Look at Georgia. Look at all the roadblocks they attempt to legally put into place specifically to create barriers for people to exercise their right to the franchise. That's something that should be infuriating people. But, you know, the thing is I know people who are so riled up over voter fraud. They're cheating. They're lying. They've stolen all the election. And look, you know, people get riled up. And, you know, some of them, as I've been saying, have mental issues. And they take things to the next level. And I look at this Michigan guy. Looks like a bunch of people I know. Could be my next door neighbor. Fortunately, he is not. Evidently calling up a congressman in California, threatening to kill him. Hey, he calls on November 3rd and says, John, hey, John, you're gonna die, John. You're going to die. Goes on Facebook, bunch of things there. Police go and look at his Facebook page, and they found tons of comments stating that half of the senators, the FBI, the CIA, the police, Tom Cruise, and Elon Musk. I don't know how Cruise and Musk got in this, but okay, throw them in. Why not? They're involved in a child slave rape ring, listing various locations where these rings are located, one of which identified the United States Capitol building. So you get these people of diminished capacity who are doing this, who are just spewing this stuff constantly. So the police go to do a wellness check on this guy, and he comes to the door with a gun, refuses to drop the gun, then eventually puts it into his sweatshirt pocket. My first thought is, you let him hold on to the gun? You didn't drop him right there? If he were a certain color, you probably would have dropped him right there. But he gets to hold on to his gun, and he says he's going to, he's going to defend himself from the government. Now, the affidavit says that while the police were talking to this guy, he went on this rant about, kids being raped, a lawsuit with Putin, and how he was calling everyone all the time, and no one was doing anything about the children. Kind of like the guy who went to the pizza place to free the kids from the basement of the pizza shop that didn't have a basement. Yeah, that again. Now, the weird thing is, while the police were at this guy's house, mom goes, he's got mental problems. Help. Worried about his safety. 2 days later, she said he was refusing mental health treatment, had a handgun, said he would protect himself from anybody trying to take the home. Now, the police have arrested him for threats for transmitting interstate commerce communications, which, I'm sorry. That doesn't seem like quite enough. As I'm reading through the story, my mind keeps going back to this place of, this is a guy who shouldn't have a gun. This is a guy who should not have a gun. And then immediately my mind went to the person who would defend. No, he's got the Second Amendment right to have a gun. Because, of course, someone who's deluded, thinking that half of the FBI, the CIA, half of Congress, and of course Elon Musk and Tom Cruise. Now, Tom Cruise and Elon Musk, I don't know, maybe. That all of them are in this big secret ring, this big cabal, this big... You see where I'm going with this? It seems a bit far-fetched, a bit extreme, a bit out on the fringe. Half the people involved in this big sex trafficking ring, and he's got access to guns. That's a problem. And now making threats. Can we admit? Can we agree? Can we come to a place where this is a start? Where we go, maybe not this guy. Can we get to a place where someone who threatens to kill their mother, like the guy who got stomped by the drag queen with the high heels after shooting a bunch of people at a gay nightclub? Can we agree that those are places where we go, yeah, that's a bit too far. See, we used to have some common sense stuff. When people would spew stuff like this, a little white van would pull up. Guys would come out in white suits and they'd go, here, I got a jacket for you. Here, put this on. The sleeves are a little long, but that's okay. We'll tailor them. And then you wouldn't see them for a while, a long while. Can we go back to that maybe? And then ensure that they don't get access to firearms so that they don't do crazy things and they don't do things like go to a nightclub and shoot people? I'm just kind of throwing it out there. Can we find some common ground? Is that available or no? Is this absolute? We want that guy to be able to have anything he wants in the event that he does decide, I'm going to go shoot up half of Congress. Is it possible? I don't know. But I'll tell you, the rhetoric we're seeing coming out of Congress, out of my Republican friends right now, the next 2 years are going to get a lot crazier by what's coming out of these hearings. And the mentally diminished, the well-armed, mentally diminished, the folks from Michigan like this guy, the FBI is going to be really busy. Duck and cover, folks.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, I look at this situation with this guy in Michigan, you know, threatening a congressman. I'm going to kill you. And look, I understand there are moments of heats of rage. You know, you get into an argument and maybe something like that flies. But you look at this guy's history, all the posts on Facebook. This is dangerous stuff. And as I've been saying, look, the next 2 years of the rhetoric coming out of the Republicans who are going to control the House really has me worried. But here to share some thoughts on, well, maybe what that's going to look like and maybe what we should be doing to help cool the temperature a bit. I've asked our good friend, former Alabama Senator Doug Jones, to come join us. Doug, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, as always, it's a pleasure.
So
happy Thanksgiving.
You as well, and happy Thanksgiving to your family as well. But I'm looking at this situation. I'm looking at this guy getting arrested and just a long list of threats and intimidation. His own mother saying he's a danger. And I'm looking at what's coming, and I'm looking down the road going, the Republicans are going to turn the temperature up, are going to activate people like this, enrage them, because everyone's a pedophile, everyone's stealing. And I fear the danger level. I fear we're stepping up many more notches than we need to be.
Yeah, no, Rick, there's no question about that. We've been that way for a while, but it is continuing. It's continuing to grow. And what is amazing to me is that people either they are just too dumb to realize the things that they're saying, or they just don't care. But the fact of the matter is, words have consequences and words matter. And it's not that some of these politicians out there are really advocating actual violence, but the things that they say triggers things in people that could very well be off the edge. We've seen that happen before. We've seen it happen in Alabama with politicians back in the 50s and 60s. We've seen it happen now, and it's more and more. I mean, the threats to members of Congress, the threats to members of legislatures, the threats to local election officials, Rick, has just gotten absolutely out of hand. And until some of these folks, and it is, you nailed it. It is primarily the extreme right that's doing this. The left has a few foibles every now and then, but it's the extreme right who really is stoking this stuff. And it's got to stop. We've got to start talking to people and get them to dial it back a little bit.
No, I mean, you brought up the election officials. We just talked about yesterday about in Arizona, where you've got the election supervisor. They're all in undisclosed locations because they're receiving death threats for simply doing their job, because somebody said, oh, there's all this fraud going on. And there's no provable fraud going on, but it doesn't matter. Once you activate the crazy, I feel for these people. And what this does, the chilling effect is good people are going to stay away from the system.
Yeah, there's no question. And Rick, what's really crazy about Arizona right now is that you haven't seen an awful lot of people screaming about fraud. It's just a few people. But what they're doing is that they're connecting the dots to 2020 and all of the things that were said at that time as well. So it's compounding the problem. And, you know, it would seem to me that the leadership in the Republican Party needs to stand up, because I have said now for a while, you've got these MAGA extremists, but you've also got enablers, people that are using this to their political advantage, that don't agree with it, but just won't stand up and speak out against it. And you've got to do more than just talk to them behind closed doors. You really got to call them out publicly in order to make this stop. And you got to challenge them one way or another. You've got to do things whether they're in the Senate or in the House. You got to do things to make sure that they know that they're taking this serious and they cannot continue down this path.
Yeah, but
we are really in dangerous territory.
Yeah, we both know that's never going to happen. All you got to do is look at what happened to Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. They're never going to take a stand against the crazy. They're not going to take a stand against the party who are pushing this stuff, because this is their pathway to victory, in my view.
It's their bread and butter right now, and that's unfortunate. It is their bread and butter. And candidly, Rick, I don't think it is that huge of a group in that MAGA extremist, but it's enough that they do not want to alienate this group, whether it's racist, whether it is just political violence, whether it's extremist, white nationalist, you call it whatever you want to, whatever the label comes, it has got, you know, the Republicans that are trying to maintain some semblance of control in the sense of the institutional control need to start doing some things about their party. And you know, look, and let's quickly note, Rick, that this is now a radical right problem, but it's not always been. And, you know, to, you know, if you remember back in the 70s, you had the Weather Underground, and sure, you had the left putting bombs out everywhere, some 5,000 bombs in about a 2-year period. And folks, you didn't see Democrats, you know, going to their rallies, calling them good people, telling them they love them, and stoking that kind of violence. You saw them calling for their investigation and prosecution and putting them behind bars. So that's what we need to see more of. We need to see more people stepping up and being responsible adults.
No, it has to happen because, you know, you can't have political leaders and people who are running the machinery fearing that they're going to have to dodge bullets. And during the break, you had said that you had gotten some death threats as well. And I'm going, you're a moderate Democrat. Well, who could hate you?
Well, the MAGA extremists always do. We got them during, you know, some of the things that was said to the young ladies who were answering my phones during the Kavanaugh hearings. You know, people calling in that they, and these young girls would answer the phone, and they, folks on the other side would tell them that they hoped that they got raped because of the things that were going on. And then after the election of 2020, and I had lost too, by the way, I mean, it's, you know, I was in the same boat that Trump was. I had lost in Alabama, but boy, we started getting stuff like crazy. And there's this one particular guy that made some really, really very pointed threats to me, another senator, and a couple of members of Congress. And the Capitol Police took it really serious, and that guy ended up serving time in prison. And I'm not sure if he's out yet or not, but they arrested him. He's out of the country, came back in. They arrested him on the spot and held him without bail.
You know, you hear these stories and you go, it shouldn't have to be this way.
No, it's not supposed to be this way. People, you know, look, these folks are doing this as a public service. You may not agree with them, but you can get a lot more when you just have a dialogue with people and you can talk to people. You can, that's how you solve issues and problems, and everybody goes forward. You don't do this with violence. That is just, that has never, ever solved anything.
No, and you know, I look at the moment we're in, and just, you know, yesterday we talked about the shooting of that nightclub in Colorado, and you know, look, it's a horrible situation, but you know, and you don't have to agree with me on this. This is purely my view, but the fact that, you know, the shooter was stomped by a guy a drag queen wearing high heels, maybe that's going to be the poster child of don't do this in the future, because you don't want your legacy to be I got beat up by a drag queen. Maybe that's the future, but again, I don't know what gives people the kind of thought process, the license to want to or to follow through on any of this stuff. But I know the rhetoric that's coming out of our Republican friends is not helpful. I look at Herschel Walker down in Georgia, just went on some bizarre rant that I was going to read, and I can't even follow it to read it, let alone understand what he meant. But I know he meant that those transgender, they're bad. That's what I got from his whole rant.
Yeah, of course, you know, that's one rant. The other one that was so bizarre, talking about violence, was werewolves being able to kill vampires. I mean, going back to that nightclub shooting, Rick, you know, it's one of the things that I have found in my work over the years is that things can trigger. You know, the rhetoric builds up, and then something triggers. And I truly believe the trigger for this guy was the rhetoric that he had seen online, the rhetoric that had been built up, all of the anti-gay rhetoric that's out there and the violence. But then the trigger, when he saw the United States Senate pass the Marriage Equality Act and 12 Republicans voted for it, it was a bridge too far. He could not handle that. And people like that were always thinking the Supreme Court would roll everything back. When it didn't happen and the Senate passed that, all of a sudden that was a trigger. I believe, I could be wrong, but I just think you start connecting those dots. It was just not a coincidence that occurred about two or three days after that vote in the United States Senate.
Wow. Yeah,
which I am very proud of, by the way. I mean, the 12 Republicans that voted for that bill, you know, God bless them.
Good on them.
They really did. They really did the country a service.
Yeah, good on them. But, you know, that's one of those issues. I remember years ago when it first came on the scene, and this is a, you know, quick story aside. I was driving, you know, for a company up north, and, you know, we were in a bunch of us were having lunch, and it came on the TV, and the guy was going on about how this gay marriage was going to ruin the sanctity of his marriage. And I remember going to go, hold on, wait a second. People, you know, marrying somehow going to harm your marriage. He was absolutely going to ruin the sanctity of my marriage. I go, but hold on, the girlfriend and the child that you have in Brockton, Massachusetts, that your wife back in Pennsylvania doesn't know about, that's not going to have anything to do. There's just this massive disconnect. But, you know, it was such a bizarre thing. And this is the same kind of thing, in my view. What has it got to do with you or anything? Stay out, mind your own business is where my mind
absolutely.
Is.
You know, look, and beyond that, you know, this you go back to how this, we've always had issues with equality in this country, even though the Declaration of Independence said all men are created equal. Well, the country has never been able to fully live up to that. It has taken us 250 years to get where we are, and we are still working on it. And we all have to try to work on it, because the more we can do to lift all boats, then the better this country is going to be.
Yeah, but here's the thing. We don't seem to be out solving problems anymore. You know, the transgender issue came up in my workplace 30 years ago. You know, Ron, we'll call him Ron. Ron went away, was gone for about 6 months. Ron came back. Ron was Rana. You know who cared? Nobody.
Nobody.
Nobody cared.
Nobody. Yeah.
The company and the union got together. We figured out how different things were going to work out. Where are you going to go to the bathroom? Where are you going to do this? And people led their lives. It wasn't the end of humanity. Why now? Why is it? Why this now?
Well, because someone found a trigger point that they could use politically. That's it. They go from one cultural trigger point to the next, and they exploit it, and they make a big deal out of it, because they think that there's enough there that can get them some extra votes and rile up a community. And that's, it's purely a political issue these days. Yeah. And it's really sad.
No, you're right. You listen to the Rick Smith Show with Doug Jones, former U.S. Senator from Alabama, talking about the craziness of the moment we're in. And I go back to this, you know, it's not about solving problems. For the next 2 years, we've already decided here on the program, every story about Republicans doing things in the House is going to be followed up with, how does this help working families? How is this going to help make your life better? How is this going to put food on the table and a roof over your head? Because it was my view. Maybe this is just the eighth grade government student that I was, who believes government decides who gets what, and we use government collectively to do the things we can't do individually. We solve problems. I want to believe that's still true. I want to believe that's the future, but sadly, we've got people who don't believe that government should, can, or will do anything, and then set out to prove it to us.
Well, you know, Rick, here's the thing that we got to do. You know, we've got a 2-year record of doing just that. I mean, this Congress, this administration's got a 2-year record of doing some really good things, whether it is the American Rescue Plan that saved people with COVID and got shots in arms, or the infrastructure bill, the CHIPS Act, the PAC Act for veterans, the Gun Safety Act, the Inflation Reduction Act. There's this whole history. And for the next 2 years, so many of those things are going to be implemented. And we got to continue to talk about that. Yeah, we're going to have to push back on all the crazies. Who really gives a damn about a laptop? You know, those kind of stuff. We got to push back on that. But we will make a huge mistake if we just let that be the narrative and only focus on that and say, no, they're wrong, they're wrong, they're wrong, and not focus on the things that are not getting done, but also on the things that are getting done based on the successes that we've had for the next 2 years. It's going to take a hell of a lot of discipline of Democrats, which we normally don't have, by the way, in terms of that messaging. But if we can stay focused on everything that we've done positive, what that does is also show the American people what they've missed for 2 years, what they can get back in 2024.
Let's talk about the next election, lastly, because I got to get what's going on in Georgia. I personally, I still can't believe that this is even a race Another woman has come forth with another allegation that another abortion was had by because of Herschel Walker, and this time threats and intimidation and all kinds of stuff. I can't even believe this is a race, but given the fact that Georgia has done some creative stuff with SB 202 and the way that this runoff's going to happen, this is going to be a lot closer than I want it to be. I know Reverend Warnock won the popular vote, but it's getting to that 50% and getting people to the polls that I'm concerned about. I'm wondering what your thoughts are.
Yeah, no, I think it is a concern. What people should understand is that, yes, the Democrats have control of the Senate, but another vote in that Senate is incredibly important. You don't want a 50-50 Senate anymore. That one vote makes a big difference in a lot of different ways, including the fact that you just don't know what's going to happen over the next 2 years. And something could happen to one of these folks. It's really important. And the fear, Rick, is that because, you know, the control of the Senate is not going to be determined by this election like it was last time, the Democrats will just relax and stay home. But you know what? People around the country, and especially people in Georgia, they need to know that, first of all, we got to get out there and help Reverend Warnock, because Georgia came through for us in 2020. We need to help them. We need to come through in 2022 for Reverend Warnock. Give him a full term. He is a man of the people, a really solid, solid United States senator that works with a lot of different people. And the one vote does make a difference. And I can tell you, it makes a huge bit of difference. You only have to go back. If John McCain had not been in the Senate, to give that famous thumbs down, the Affordable Care Act would have gone down. That one vote can absolutely matter, and yeah, we really need to get folks out there. And and it's sad that it is this close because of the differences. The contrast between these two candidates is just stunning. But we are in such a tribal situation down in the South, in Georgia and Alabama, and throughout these states in the Deep South, where, you know, party affiliation means so much to too many people. It always needs to mean something for some voters. I get that. And you got to have that base of voters. But right now, that's the only thing that matters to so many people. It is close because of the tribalism in these states. And that is really unfortunate.
Is that breakable?
It's breakable, but it's going to take some time. I mean, it is breakable, but both Democrats and Republicans need to want to break it. They need to, you know, Republicans need to want to break it in certain blue states, and Democrats ought to want to break it in the deep red states. And you know, the thing is not to necessarily flip a state, but to get a two-party system where you're competitive. That's how states move forward. And that's, I think it is, we got a whole new generation of folks. If we can get young people voting like they did in 2022, then yeah, it is absolutely breakable, because these younger voters, they don't put up with this crap.
Well, let us hope. But Senator, it's great, great having you on the program. I have a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday. I look forward to having you back again real soon.
You got it, Rick. Anytime. Take care, buddy.
Good stuff. Former Alabama Senator Doug Jones. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back right after this. 1-866-416-RICK. 1-866-416-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1909. That was the evening when a crowd began to gather at the Cooper Union in the heart of New York City's shirtwaist garment-making industry. A meeting had been called by the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, Local 25, to discuss whether garment workers should go out in a general strike. Working conditions and pay throughout the industry were abysmal. It was common for workers to toil 11 hours a day with only a 30-minute lunch break 7 days a week. But organizing all these workers was a challenge. challenge. Many spoke various dialects of Yiddish or Italian, so organizing had to take place in multiple languages. But slowly, the organizing efforts began to build and show results. Pickets and walkouts were held against some employers. The union called a meeting to discuss what to do next. They voted to strike after a stirring speech in Yiddish from Clara Lemlich, a founder of the ILGWU Local 25. The strike came to be known as the Uprising of 20,000. It lasted until February. In a settlement, more than 300 factories agreed to recognize the union. A song from the educational department of the ILGWU captured the spirit of the strike. The lyrics began, "In the black winter night of 1909, we froze and bled on the picket line. We showed the world that women could fight, and we rose and won with women's might." The song continued, "And we gave new courage to the men who carried on in 1910. And shoulder to shoulder we'll win through, led by the ILGWU."
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So just down the road from where I live, Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, there's a little borough. It's a borough. I was going to say hamlet, but no, it's a borough. It's a little borough in the northern part of the Lancaster County there, who over the last 30 years has been kicking it a couple of bucks to the Ephrata Public Library System. This little borough gives, I think the number was $20,000 they give to the library, $5 per resident. That's how small the place is, just 4,000 people. But they give 20 grand to the library to help keep the library functioning and doing the things that they do, that libraries do, you know, promoting reading and stuff. Well, evidently, the Akron Borough Council. And yes, there is an Akron, Pennsylvania, just like Akron, Ohio, but only in Pennsylvania. They have cut the line item for the Ephrata Public Library right out of their general budget. No more $20,000 for the library. Now, it's a small expense, but it's an ideological one because one councilman opposed a woman's health class because it was related to sex matters. Yeah, that's what you got on the borough council. And this is the world that we're heading towards, where extremists and radicals and, well, head sand people are going to defund institutions and run for office specifically to push a narrow-minded, puritanical view of what this country should be and how you should live. And this is one of those things. Look, I'm a believer in you lead your best life. And I've said this from the very beginning. If you're against gay marriage, don't do it. If you're against abortion, don't have one. It seems pretty simple to me. Life is pretty simple when you get down to the nuts and bolts of it. Mind your business. Let other people mind theirs. As long as what people are doing in the confines of their four walls breaks no laws, that's their business. My grandfather always said, don't worry about me, worry about yourself. This seems fairly appropriate at this moment. But you're going to have this kind of activist little, this is how far the conservative movement has burrowed down into destroying our government. And look, will the $20,000 matter to the public library? Yeah, maybe not. Maybe not as much. It'll hurt maybe a little bit. You know, they'll not offer one program or have to not get as many books next year. But what does this say? What does this say to the kids in that area? It's angering and it's frustrating. The library is supposed to be the place where knowledge is accumulated, where you go to explore new things, to research, to actually do research. Actually do the research. You know, I know everyone did my research. Where?
whenever I hear someone say I did my research, I always ask them, can I see the reading list? Can you provide me a list of sources? And that's always met with a quizzical look of what are sources? You know, things at the library that you've just defunded. Now, I have to wonder if this is now going to be something that is going to pick up steam in other places. Because I see this and I now have to wonder, is this going to be a situation where this is part of a national plan to defund public libraries? To where this is now a national plan that Akron is now it was on the list, and now we're going to work all the way down to, you know, down to Z, and every community is going to do nonsense like this. Shame on you, Akron. Especially when you consider, according to the library system, more than half of the people in Akron actually use their library card. What a shame. What a shame. Love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the story has come out that the SMART Union, the Sheet Metal Workers, Air, Rail, and Transportation Workers Union, has voted down the tentative agreement that was made on the rails with the Biden administration and the rail companies. And you look at the reality. These rail companies, wow, I was looking at some of the profitability numbers. Wow. BNSF saw their net income jump by 16% to $5.9 billion in 2021. You've got Union Pacific, which had the most profitable year ever in fiscal year 2021. And you see that CSX saw a 37% jump in its 2021 revenue earnings, up to $3.8 billion. There's a lot of money here. You know what they're not doing? Not sharing it. And not just that, it's the conditions. And here to share some thoughts on how this is going, why it was voted down, and maybe where we go from here, I've asked Jared Cassidy to come talk with us. Jared is the Assistant National Legislative Director for the SMART Unions, the Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transport Union. Jared, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So tell me, what's going on? What happened?
Well, so what you're seeing is a lot of frustration and a lot of anger from the membership. And really, it's the backlash from years of precision scheduled railroading by the railroads. I mean, that's ultimately what is driving the motivation for the members at this point. I mean, they're frustrated. They're angry. They're mad. They've been mistreated. They haven't had any dignity or respect from the railroads for years. And they're basically telling the world it's time for a change. And the best way they can do that is through the vote of an agreement. And you know, I've talked about it kind of candidly with a lot of folks, but if our ballot had a third box on it that basically said strike, and they could have chosen yes, no, or strike, I think the majority would have been at a strike position simply because precision scheduled railroading has taken such a toll. And you were talking about the gains that the railroads have made. You know, the irony of that is that the customers and the shippers have for the last 3 years been complaining to the STB about a lack of service. I mean, they can't even depend on the railroads to deliver their goods. And yet they're still making record profits. I mean, it's unfathomable to think that a railroad or any corporation for that matter could actually do a worse job at servicing their customers and make record profits. Yet that's where we find ourselves, and our members are right in the heart of that. And you're seeing that frustration and that anger play out.
Yeah, no, look, I spend a lot of time in the rail yards here in the Harrisburg area. And I'll tell you, you know, the trains aren't always on time. There's a lot of frustration with the people. And look, you know, the folks that I talk to there, the frustration is they can't keep people. And a big part of this is, you know, the hours that people have to work, the people who are there, they abuse and take advantage of. And some of them, the struggle is still the wages and the hours.
Yeah. I mean, the hours are just insane, really, for a lot of the men and women that are out there working on the trains. and the conditions are right there with it. You know, I mean, our folks go to work and, you know, they're constantly being observed. And what I mean by that, excuse me, is they go out there and the railroad managers want to observe them doing their daily task and basically try to catch them doing something wrong. That's been around forever in the railroad mentality, but now they're flying drones over their head. And so our folks are out there working and they've got to deal with this constant buzzing of a drone flying over, watching every move they make while they're tired and fatigued because the railroad rang their phone all night long to see if they were qualified on territories that the railroad knew good and well that they weren't qualified, yet they kept them awake all night trying to see if they could trick somebody into taking a train. And so it's, to explain it in a segment as short as this, it's almost impossible. But I mean, you know, what you hit on is spot on. It's, there is so much going on right now in the railroad industry, and basically they have cut way too deep. And now they're tasking everybody else with trying to pick up the slack. And ironically, you know, when they made that cut, there was no room for slack in their operations. And so we have found ourselves where we are. And it's sad for the nation, really, because, you know, when you think about it, the lack of transportation that's occurring on the railroad industry right now can be argued by a lot of people that is quite possibly responsible for the supply chain crisis and even the inflation we're seeing.
Yeah, a lot of it. I absolutely agree. But this is where I get conspiratorial a little bit. Because I'm looking at this, and I'm looking at the amount of wealth being created by these railroads, the money they're putting in their pockets, they're paying their CEOs, the revenue that's coming in, that this could be operated so much differently. This could be operated with set schedules. You could hire more people. We've done it before. We've done it in the past. It was there before. It seems to me, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, that this is a created crisis to get to a place to where maybe, well, we just don't have enough manpower. We have to go down to a one-person crew on a train. Or maybe we just fully automate trains and we don't have people at all because, hey, we can't get people to come to work in these horrible, deplorable conditions with this precision scheduling railroading that we've jammed down their throats.
Yeah, so if you're a conspiracy theorist, you're not alone. There's a lot of people having that conversation right now. And it has been discussed and tossed around that somehow this is all self-created to show a need for people that they can't fill. And then lo and behold, what we have to do next is cut our way to where we can make more gains operationally. Because that's what all this has all been about over the last 7 years, is cutting their way to profits. You know, longer trains, less people, anything they can do to cut and make more money. And ironically, they've been somewhat successful at, but now you're starting to see the realities of that. And is there a scenario where the railroads could actually contemplate, you know, cutting their way to the fact that they don't have enough people for, say, a conductor to be on the cab of the locomotive? I would tell you that keeps me up at night because, you know, it's not just the job loss that's really the threat here. It's the safety to the public that's most important. It's the data that the industry doesn't keep, that the conductor is responsible for, that is really at stake. And I would tell you that in America, we hit somebody, something every 3 hours on average. And the railroads like to compare us to Europe, but it's not comparable. They don't have the same infrastructure. They don't have the same amount of crossings. They don't have a lot of things that we don't have. Train length is different. But as a conductor, for me, there have been several times where I have blown the whistle because the engineer was busy doing their thing with the software programs and all the stuff they have to deal with. But if there's a child coming out and the engineer doesn't see it, so I blow the whistle and that child goes away, it seems so trivial. It seems so fundamental. But the reality of it is in that 3 to 5 seconds, that kid was on a path to a fatal injury, a fatal accident. And because of the actions of a conductor, just simply blowing a whistle, that child's life was saved. But the unfortunate piece of that is that story doesn't get collected. It never gets told. And if we pull the conductor off the cab of the locomotive, the only way we're going to find out really how important they are is those numbers will trickle up. Yeah. And it will result in the life of folks that, I mean, it's just, it's an unfathomable, it's a terrifying scenario for me to consider.
No, it's amazing to me that you're talking about, as profitable as these companies are, they can't make these conditions better. So let me ask you flat out, is there a way to make this, to make the trains run on time, to give people the ability to have lives so they can have actual weekends off and not a day a month or whatever scheme they dreamt up? Is there a way that people can have decent lives and still have a decent job and our country to still have the infrastructure to move our goods around? Is there a scenario where that is at all possible?
Yeah, the answer for me is let labor have a seat at the table. This shouldn't be a corporate operated world. We should have input in the operations for the businesses that we make run. And when it comes to railroading, labor should have a seat at the table when we're looking at operational schemes, when we're looking at safety programs, when we're doing all these things. Labor is constantly cut out. And I think what these railroads and corporations in general will find is that labor needs the job. We need the job to take care of our families. We want to take ownership and an active role and what it is that we do. And if they would just allow us to even sit there and have some input, we could influence a realistic way to make things better for everybody. And I mean, it's, you know, we don't want to bring harm to the companies. We don't want to bring harm to anybody. We want to do our jobs. We want to service our customers. And it's just unfortunate that no one will really, For most, we're just a hurdle. We're an obstacle. We're that thing that they got to get past.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be that way. We should be allowed to take part. I mean, shorter trains, faster trains, it makes more sense. The frequency, the fluidity of the infrastructure, you know, that's just one very simple change that we can make. As an engineer myself, it makes sense. It's easier to operate those trains and you can maintain track speed. When you run a train that's 5 miles long, which we're doing every day now on the BNSF up north, over 60,000 tons, over 26,000 feet daily. That train moves literally like a caterpillar. Why not break it up the way it was designed so that it stops off crossings, that it actually fits in sidings, it doesn't slow everything else, and it moves at track speed at 60, 70 mile an hour instead of 15, 17. I mean, it just... they're simple decisions that we should have a part in making or influencing. Yeah. That would improve things for the better.
Now, this is what happens when you get bean counters making decisions instead of actually people who've run the rails. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Jared Cassidy. Jared's the Assistant National Legislative Director of SMART, the Sheet Metal Air Rail Transport Union. You can check out their website, smart-union.org. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that stuff. So let me ask you the question of the day. Is there going to be a strike? Is this going to happen?
Holy cow. So that is the loaded question. And I don't have the answer for that. The president, meaning the president of the United States, President Biden, has been pretty clear that he is concerned about the threat of a strike. He has been out in publications and media. In fact, I was reading an article before I got on here that, you know, out of concern for the supply chain of America, which is understandable, it's on his mind. I can tell you that leadership in Congress is concerned. There are some things we have to work out. We are back at the table, so to speak, with the carriers. We're not too optimistic that anything actually is going to come out of that. I will tell you we're hopeful. I mean, we would love to have an agreement, a mutual agreement between the two sides, but it's not something that we can be terribly optimistic about. And so I don't know. That's the answer. I wish I could give you something more definitive. I know our folks are ready to go and we're ready to fight with them. They deserve better, and we want to make sure that they get better. And if it takes a strike, by God, we're going to be walking the street with them, and we have our boots strapped up and ready to go. And we're going to do whatever it takes to get the job done. But at the end of the day, what Congress does, I wish I had that magic crystal ball, and I am the guy for the union, or one of the guys for the union that works on the Hill that tries to figure that out. And we do have a hill to climb at the moment. But we're going to do what we need to do for our membership.
Now, Secretary Walsh has said that Congress will, he believes that Congress will step in. And I would assume to get past the holidays, put another cooling off period in place. Do you see that as a possibility?
I hope not. I will not mince words here. I think a cooling off period would be horrible for our situation. Our membership would not accept that very well whatsoever. It would, in fact, I think that's probably the worst decision out of all this. Congress has a lot of options at play, but the extension of a cooling off period for me is kind of a non-starter. I don't see that scenario playing well for the members.
So are you talking possibly a wildcat strike, or are you looking at something else?
No, we wouldn't support a wildcat strike. It's illegal. The financial implications that would come upon the union for that would not be wise. So, you know, if they force an extension on us, Rick, I'm saying that we would not do anything illegal. We will be in accordance with the law. But if they do extend it, my point is I don't think the membership would be really happy with that.
Yeah, the reason I bring that up is you can't control what your members ultimately would do in the event that, look, there is anger out there. And I've talked to some of the people, and this is something that has come up, and that's the reason I ask. And I know the union's position, but ultimately it's the members, right?
It is the members. I mean, the members drive the union. They make all the decisions. Everything that we do and act on originates from them. But that being said, we also have the obligation as officers to protect the integrity of the union. Right. And acting outside the scope of law would obviously be a failure on our part if we were to do that. So
absolutely,
to do anything that's illegal, we can't condone or sponsor, if you will.
Right. No, I get it. Absolutely. So last line of questioning I've got for you then, what do we do? You know, what do our listeners do? What do I do? You know, what's the way forward? Because, you know, a cooling off period, as you've said, is something that you find unacceptable, which has been one of the only ways that we've been told is a possibility to avert this in the short term. What is a better path that you see, Jared?
We need public pressure, and not just pressure on Congress, but pressure on the railroads too. You know, we need to let the carriers know and Congress know alike that the public is on our side. And I believe that wholeheartedly. I mean, we're asking for stuff like sick time. We're asking for stuff like quality of life, the ability to be a husband, to be a father, to be a brother, whatever it may be. You know, we're not able to do that right now. And so we need to let the folks that are trying to pull the strings on us to know that the public is on our side here. We're not asking for too much. We're not even outside of our lane. We just want to be treated decently with dignity and respect. And that's what we're asking. And things like sick time, things like the ability to take a mental break if you need one. The railroad is actually very stressful. You know, we should be able to pause our lives for a minute, professionally speaking, if that's what we need for the safety of not just ourselves, but everyone else, that the communities that we intervene. And so that public pressure, that is what we need. We need folks contacting their members of Congress, their senators. And it wouldn't even bother me if folks are riding the railroads and saying, hey, I stand with the workers. You know, give these folks some time off. Yeah. Quit doing what you're doing. That's what we need.
No, 130 years ago, 135 years ago, workers fought, bled, and died for the right for 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will. And here we are in a moment where you've got guys who don't get 8 hours for what you will for an entire month.
That's exactly right. And the railroad unions were a big part of that. And, you know, here we are at one of those turning moments in our lives. And, you know, we got new generations coming in and new thoughts and new ideas and really stuff that they're not going to put up with. And so, you know, we need to make this career better, but we can do it in a way, especially with the kind of money we're talking about. I mean, they're turning billions of profit every quarter. There's no sense in cutting us and keep cutting us and keep cutting us. We actually matter to their bottom line. In fact, we drive their bottom line. I would dare say we are the ultimate reason for their bottom line. And if they want to see their company successful, then they need to invest in our folks and let us do our jobs, and the rest will take care of it.
So. Amen. Good stuff. The website, smart-union.org. You can go for more information there. Jared Cassidy, appreciate the time, man.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Rick.
Have a good holiday, and I wish you the best in this. You can, again, check out the website, smart-union.org. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find yours, you will find ours, from Stitcher to Podbean, iHeart, iTunes, all of that. Right back after this. you're a fan of the show, you've heard our Labor History in Two segments, and you can hear them on the radio pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Labor history has never been more important than it is right now. So here's what we'd like you to do. Tell a teacher. Tell a teacher that labor history is important and that they can get digestible two-minute lessons that are absolutely free. Free to download, free to use, free to share. Tell a teacher to go to thericksmithshow.com/history and help us put labor back where it belongs, in the classroom. You know, generations of American workers fought, bled, and died to build the American way of life. It's our job to keep their stories alive. Go tell a teacher that we're here to help them do just that. Find us at thericksmithshow.com/history today.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I got to tell you, I look at the profits of these rail companies, and it's insane. I mean, it really is. And this is where, you know, I forgot to ask Jared. You know, there's part of me that goes, at some point, doesn't the threat of nationalizing the railroads have to pop up? Because clearly they're not operating totally in the interests of we the people. They're operating in the interests of their shareholders. It's all about them. That's it. I mean, when you see that, you know, BNSF, their net income jumped 16% to $5.9 billion in 2021. In the first 9 months of fiscal year 2022, its parent company bought $27.1 billion in stock buybacks. Understand, it's BNSF is a subsidiary of Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. So we're talking huge, enormous money here. They could afford to ensure that workers have a couple of days off. You know, and this is the thing. I don't think most people understand what the requirements to be one of these engineers is. These guys, they literally live to work. Once they get on that train, it takes them, you know, 10, 12 hours down the track. A van then picks them up, drives them to a hotel. And then, you know, they sit in a hotel and wait for that phone to ring. And then the phone's ringing all the time. Hey, can you go here? Can you go there? And look, there are only certain things that people are qualified for because there are things you need to know. And these companies know what person's qualified for which runs and which things they can and can't do, but yet still pushing. Hey, you can do that. Hey, you can do that. Knowing that it's your license. It's your responsibility. And I go back to, I've had people complain about, well, the union isn't doing anything. You go, you think about how bad it is now. Imagine if there was no union. Imagine if you had not even this amount of say. And this is where, to me, we need to be strengthening unions across the board. To where in this situation, when my grandparents' generation was ruling the roost, there would be trucking companies lined up, warehouses. There would be people striking with them, boycotting. There would be people not going into the rail yards. They go, okay, you're going to treat people with dignity and respect. You're going to treat them decent, or we're going to shut you down. And what has our Republican friends do? What has our corporate control of government done? Well, we've legislated all that stuff away. And it's going to get worse. But I look at these operating ratios and the stock buybacks and all this stuff, and you go, you know what? A mere fraction of that would make these people's lives better. A mere fraction of literally a crumb would make these people's lives livable, would bring in new people, new blood, to be able to take the next generation of jobs. And I truly believe, the more I'm seeing this, the more I'm reading about what's going on and how profitable these companies are and the fact that they've been pushing the one-man crew for a long time, that this is a huge part in pushing that agenda to force Congress to go, oh, well, you don't have enough people to do the job? You can't get people to come and work in these conditions? Oh, well, then I guess we do have to go down to one-person crews. And then they're going to make that job so unbearable that what? Nobody will do it? Oh, I guess we have to automate. I guess we have to have the invisible driver there. And what's that going to mean? Well, it's going to mean chaos. It's going to mean people will die. But you know who doesn't care? The railroads. Never have. It's all about the profit. It's about the bottom line. Good on these workers for standing up. And as Jared said, call your congressman. Call them early, call them often. Say you support the railroad workers. That's all you got to do. Quick break, right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, interesting video on the Twitters came across my feed. This Nolan Rosenkrantz, he's a former president of the Toledo News Guild, now currently a staff rep with the News Guild, CWA, ran across this guy, Alan Block, multimillionaire, rich guy, owns a bunch of newspapers. I think I actually own the Toledo Blade, if I'm not mistaken. But right now, Block and the Newspaper Guild, the News Guild folks, are in a strike situation in Pittsburgh. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette's been on strike for a while. Ran across him and this Block and his wife at a rest stop. And, well, oh, what an interesting bit of minute video. And I'm going to put that back out on social media so folks can take a look at it. The first part of it I can't play because too many expletives. But what's interesting is Mr. Block, you know, begins to answer a question about, hey, you know, why are you going through this, with the stock answer of, well, you know, blah, blah, blah. He turns around, sees who it is, and then an expletive-laden rant hits the guy with a bag and then marches off. Well, this reporter, Nolan, good on him, following along, asking simple questions. This one in particular caught my attention. Thought you should probably hear.
Why'd you cut off the health care of your workers?
We didn't. That's all a lie.
No, it's not a lie.
It's a lie.
It's not a lie.
You're lying.
I'm not lying at all.
You're lying.
You know, since Alan has been in charge of the newspapers,
you know what? No one's.
He hasn't given a raise to employees at the Toledo Blade once. Once. I did leave. I'm not at the papers anymore.
Good.
So but what about the people that are there?
They should get other jobs if they're not happy.
They should get other jobs if they're not happy. How about you just be ethical owners?
They should just
be ethical owners.
They should just get other jobs if they're not happy. And this again, is the right-wing frame. This is the billionaire flame. Not happy, go somewhere else. Instead of, well, fight and make things better. And here to talk about how they're fighting to make things better, I've asked Zach Tanner to come talk with us. Zach is the interactive designer over at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, currently on strike. Also the president of the Newspaper Guild of Pittsburgh. Zach, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rick.
So this little interaction that Mr. Rosenkrantz and the multimillionaire Mr. Block had, very typical of the kind of dynamic that the employer class thinks of the servant class. Because for me, the dynamic right from the start is the reporter asks a question and you start getting this stock answer until he turns and sees who it is. And then immediately sees that person as almost less than human, someone he can hit with his bag.
Yeah, right. And this is not like atypical for this family either. I mean, it was well publicized back in 2019 that Alan's twin brother, John, the publisher of the Post-Gazette, came into like the newsroom on a Saturday night and ranted and raved to his daughter in front of like a bunch of journalists that like, they're the Blocks, they're high class, they're better than the workers that work for the paper. And like, that's how they view themselves. And I think that's like really why we're in this labor situation at the Post-Gazette, why we're on strike right now, because like these multi-generational multi-millionaires just have no respect for the workers who make their product. If it wasn't for the workers at the Post-Gazette and the Toledo Blade, Block Communication wouldn't exist. And they wouldn't have their millions of dollars that they inherited from their family. And now, as we sit here in 2022, they think it's okay to like literally smack reporters and smack union reps with like a bag of Wendy's at a rest stop. It's like completely absurd and insulting.
Yeah, but again, it's one of these things where you go, it is predictable. It is how they view their workers in many cases. And this idea of benevolent dictators, you know, it comes out right out to play. Well, you know, well, if you don't like it, you can leave. And you go, well, wait a second. If everyone is as bad as you are, Where are you going to leave to? This is where I keep going. Every worker needs a union. Every worker needs a contract. Every worker needs to be able to fight back against bad bosses like this.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And like, that's why we're on strike, right? Because we're striking to like protect the workers at the papers. We're striking to protect the contract at the papers. And we're striking to make sure that like the Post-Gazette, despite like this family and the things that they do and the insults that they hurl toward their workers like day in and day out, is like a great community asset for like decades to come, right? Like, we want the Post-Gazette to be a great place for great journalists to come work. Seemingly John and Alan Block don't share that sentiment. So we want to, you know, get a fair contract, secure a contract that we can then build upon from that to make sure that the Post-Gazette stays strong.
Yeah, I mean, I can't, maybe it's just me, but I'm watching this video and I'm watching it again right now. I can't get that interaction out of my head in going, you know, this is sadly where we are in this country, where you have these enormously wealthy people who feel that they have the power and influence and the ability to do whatever to whomever they choose without repercussion, without being answerable to anyone. And when someone does have the audacity, someone dares to question them, they lash out. I mean, this is, I guess, the sign of our times, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate, but I think it's true. And, you know, I think that this also comes from, like I mentioned, like they inherited every dime they have. They've never
made their money the old fashioned way.
That's right. From
daddy's trust fund.
Exactly. And I think that's like an inherent problem, right? Like, they've never worked a day in their life. They don't know what it's like to, like, you know, have to sit around and wonder how you're going to pay for like Thanksgiving dinner, right? Like, they've never thought about that. And that like really disconnects them from the workers who make the paper and who produce the product that makes them money. And I think like with that disconnect, like, you're just going to have these, like you said, like rich elites, quote unquote. I don't know if I'd consider them elite or not, but they certainly consider themselves to be that way, treating workers this way. It's despicable.
So now, when is the next bargaining session? I mean, at some point, this is going to have to go to resolution. At some point, he's going to have to sit across from the table from, well, you guys and, well, the guy he hit with the bag. At some point, you're going to have to answer for that. At some point, this is where accountability comes in and workers collectively organizing and bargaining coming together will hold some accountability. What are we expecting?
Yeah, so we had two bargaining sessions last week that we didn't make much progress at, frankly, and that's because the company didn't come with the intention of making much progress. We have another date on the books for Tuesday, December 6th. That'll be the next time we meet with the company. And we're hopeful that when we go to the table this time, they come with like some really like concrete offers and concrete proposals to end this strike, get a signed CBA, and get everybody back to work.
And I ask this question every time there's a strike situation. How much of this is truly financial, is truly the company's acting in its own best interest financially to try and keep the ship afloat or keep moving and how much of this is just pure, blatant, straight out union busting?
You know, if you want my opinion, as we sit here today, I think it is blatant union busting. At the table, whenever we've talked economics, the answer that they always say is like, it's not that we don't have the ability to pay, it's that we don't want to pay. And one of our demands when we went on strike to go back to work was to settle the non-economic issues that are outstanding in our contract and then bargain the economics later. Like, we came in really good faith. Like, here's like an easy solution to get back, to get us back to work and then bargain a CBA. We went to bargaining last week with some non-economic, like jurisdictional kind of things at the table to talk about. And the company just flat out rejected every single thing that we took to them. They were not interested in talking about these non-economic topics. So if they're not claiming an inability to pay, they're just saying that they don't want to, and they're not willing to bargain over non-economic issues like union security issues, union jurisdiction. Like, what's that tell you? That tells you that they are out to bust the union, and that means they are out to harm the workers at the paper.
So, you know, in looking at this, and there's part of me that goes, again, this is why we need major comprehensive labor law reform to hold these kind of people accountable. Because, you know, in looking at this, how much of this is Block himself, and how much of this are the lawyers that they hire to cash in on the billable hours, or is it both?
I think it's both. I mean, like, you know, the lawyers are hired hands. They're very evil hired hands that are anti-worker, right? But they're still hired hands. So like the dictation is coming from the blocks as they hire them. But these lawyers that they have employed are very good at racking up billable hours for sure. As an example, we had an NLRB hearing in front of an administrative law judge based on some bad faith bargaining complaints that we had moved forward by the National Labor Relations Board. And representing us was our one single labor attorney, Joe Pass, and representing the company over 5 days of hearing was four different attorneys. And I can't even imagine what these union busting attorneys charge per hour. In fact, I can probably make a guess based on some back of the napkin math that those four attorneys over 5 days cost more than the settlement and the strike would have cost. Whoa. You know, it's pure union busting. They want these attorneys to be charging these fees so that they can pay them rather than us. Yeah. Isn't that awful? Like, you can't create a newspaper with attorneys. You can create a newspaper with reporters and designers and copy editors and photographers. And that's what we're trying to make them understand.
Now, I was talking to somebody the other day about just about this strike and one of the issues being your health care. And I said, what's remarkable to me is they cut off your health care and said, hey, you could come on to our crummy plan that you don't want, but you were actually willing to pay the difference of the cost. So it wouldn't have cost them a dime more out of their pocket. What it would have cost them is the money that they would have made off of those plans that they don't want anybody to know about. But it wouldn't have cost them anything to just give their employees what their employees actually want and need for their families. This was a power play more than anything. So, of course, they kicked all their employees off their health care, say, well, if you won't take what we're giving you, we're not giving you anything. And it's that kind of, I don't know, it's that kind of mean and spiritedness. It's that kind of, you know, backdoor, you know, I just get angry.
Oh, trust me, we get angry too. This has been just typical of them at the bargaining table since the contracts expired back in 2017 for all the different unions. You know, like we go to them with like productive ideas. Like we go to them with a healthcare plan that says like, all right, like all of the unions will band together and we'll go on our own plan. And like, all you have to do is just kind of pay the same amount that you're paying now and we'll be on a different plan. And their answer is no, because they want like a bigger pool of people in their insurance plan. Yep. That's worse and more expensive, like three times more expensive for some people. And it is really just truly like a their way or the highway, like to use like an outdated cliche, like that's it. They want it their way and they want the absolute ability to dictate any changes or anything like that. It is just, I don't know.
No, cause my mind goes to
pure contempt.
My mind goes to the place where you go, okay, well, why is this an absolute? Is it that the company that you're getting your insurance from will give it to you free if you take us on? What's the benefit? What's the kickback to you? You know, what's the sweetener for you, Mr. Block? You're listening to The Rick Smith Show with Zach Tanner. Zach's an interactive designer at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, president of the Newspaper Guild of Pittsburgh. You can check out the website to how you can donate before this holiday season, cwa.org/ppg-donate. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that and help in this moment to help these families make it through the holiday season. Because look, it's starting to get colder. The holidays are coming up. This is a tough time, especially to be on strike. And I don't have to tell you, Zach, because you and your members are out there on the line. How is morale? How are things holding up in this moment?
You know, I think for the folks on strike, morale is actually like not too bad, all things considered. You know, like we're energized. We're angry after the bargaining sessions last week that didn't go well, even though we came with like some really easy good faith solutions to end the strike. But you know, that kind of amps everybody up. And like, yeah, it's almost the holidays, but like, you know what? Like the Communication Workers of America, we all have like $100 grocery store gift cards from CWA to buy Thanksgiving dinner with. We have a strike relief fund that's pushing over $70,000. And if you go to, you mentioned the URL just a minute ago. And if you go to unionprogress.com, there's a donate button there. All that money goes like straight to the striking families. That's again, almost over $70,000 now. It's funny, like the workers on strike and all of like our labor colleagues across the country, like we all have each other's backs here. We're like uplifting each other. And I've been at the Post-Gazette for 8 years now. In fact, one of those like awful bargaining dates last week happened on my 8-year anniversary of being hired at the newspaper and starting there. And in those 8 years, I never got any kind of like, oh, here's $100 for Thanksgiving or for the holidays to like go grocery shopping with. It took going on strike for like all of like the fellow laborers, all the fellow workers in this world to like pitch in and like give this support system to the workers. It's like been really empowering, frankly. It's been like really encouraging to know that like while the ownership and while like the elites couldn't care less about us, they don't even pay attention to us at the bargaining table, all of us workers have each other's backs, and like nobody's gonna fall while we're on strike. We're all holding each other up.
There you go. Let's talk a little bit about real quick about the Union Progress site, theunionprogress.com. You guys have started a news site out of this, using your talents, you know, trying to get some good news out there. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so the unionprogress.com, the Pittsburgh Union Progress, that's our strike publication that we're publishing while the strike's going on. I kind of use the phrase, like, keep talking to the Post-Gazette reporters. It just happens to be our work's being published on a different website than normal, while the Post-Gazette apparently doesn't want our work. You know, and we're really starting to, like, expand our coverage, too. You know, this is a strike publication, so, like, one of its core missions is to report on the strike. But we're also just reporting on the beats that we've been reporting on for our whole careers. We have transportation reporting, you know, we have community reporting, you know, social journalism, all kinds of good stuff like that. And in fact, like a big committee met today in person at a coffee shop in Pittsburgh and just kind of hammered out like some pie in the sky brainstorm ideas, some brainstorm ideas that like might not be able to kind of come to life within the bounds of like a legacy newspaper. But for a new strike publication that doesn't kind of have any like baggage alongside of it, that kind of like reimagining what kind of things we can write. So there's actually like some really exciting stuff going on at unionprogress.com. And like, I encourage everybody to check it out and follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where we're kind of posting our stories all the time.
Big fan. I hope folks will take a look at it. This is the kind of stuff, this is the kind of, you know, the kind of screw you that should come with every strike. Yeah, we'll just pick up our ball and we're going to go in a different direction. We're going to produce what we were producing without you, rich guy. We'll show you. I kind of like it. So I hope folks will take a look at unionprogress.com. Also, cwa.org/PPG-donate. I know that's a lot. Just go to therickSmithShow.com. We'll get some links out on social media and how you can take a look at those things and make a donation. Help the folks out. But, Zach, I appreciate the time. I wish you guys the best. Good luck through the holidays, and I hope the best on December 6th.
Appreciate it, Rick. We'll keep you updated.
Good stuff. Appreciate the time. Going to take a quick break. Right back here. Again, cwa.org/PPG-. Go there, make a small donation, help out during the holidays. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1909. That was the day that a young garment worker by the name of Clara Lemlich made a speech that would have a resounding impact on the labor movement in New York City. Lemlich was at a union meeting where she sat listening to men discuss whether garment workers should call a general strike. Finally, she asked to speak. She said, "I have listened to all of the speakers, and I have no further patience for talk. I am a working girl, one of those striking against intolerable conditions. I am tired of listening to speakers who talk in generalities. What we are here for is to decide whether or not to strike. I make a motion that we go out in a general strike." The female shirtwaist makers were trapped in unskilled, poorly paying jobs. This workforce was more than 70% women, mainly Italian and Jewish immigrants. These bottom-tier workers worked for $3 to $4 per week. Semi-skilled operators earned between $7 and $12 per week. At the top of the hierarchy stood the highly skilled cutters and pattern makers, who in some cases could earn more than $20 a week. The day after Clara's inspiring speech, 15,000 shirtwaist workers walked out of their workplaces. Workers at 339 of the 352 shirtwaist manufacturing companies in New York City went out on strike. It grew and became known as the Uprising of the 20,000. It was the largest strike by women up until that moment in American history. Strikers faced opposition from manufacturers, the police, and the courts. The strike was not settled until February of the following year.
factory owners agreed to meet the workers' demands, including higher pay and shorter hours. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickSmithShow.com. Yes, the holidays are here. We will be taking a break for the next couple of days to celebrate Thanksgiving and the holiday with our families. I hope the best for everyone in this holiday season. And this is one of my favorite holidays, because I am always eternally grateful for the fortunes that I've been given, and the opportunities that I've had, and the little program, and everyone who listens, always grateful for that. So this is kind of one of those thankful. I'm not that sentimental, weepy, but I am grateful, and this is one of those holiday seasons that makes you think about that, and fortunate to have the things that we have, and the people around us that we have. So I hope the best for everybody. The same spiel every holiday, full of friends and family and memories and all of that stuff. So best holiday to everyone. Again, we will be off through the holiday, back on Monday. Looking forward to that. So always good to take a day, rejuvenate, recharge, re-energize, all of that stuff. So we're going to do that. Now, look, I look at what's going on there at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. This is, again, rich guy deciding, you're going to get what I give you. And this is one of those moments. Seriously, this is one of those moments where working people have to look long and hard in the environment that we're in. Because you look at this Alan Block, and again, I hope people will take a look at the video and the response. It's the first couple of seconds for me that really is the most important, because, they meet at this rest stop, and a guy from behind, asks a question. Hey, why are you doing this? And out comes the stock answer that, we're losing with this, and whatever their corporate answer was, we're losing money, and blah 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 blah. And then he turns and he sees that it's a former worker and a former employee, or someone that he thinks is an employee, and immediately his demeanor changes from that of, this is someone I have to take seriously, this is someone I have to give a stock answer, because to someone that I can literally turn around and smack like a child. And it's that interaction to me is one of those really important, true moments. All the press releases and all the PR spin and all of the nonsense aside, that core moment, that gut reaction of him turning around and smacking, oh, blank you, and smacking him with the bag. It doesn't get much more honest than that. And that tells you what that employer thinks of his employees. That tells you the mentality. And understand, it's not just this one guy. This guy's a dirtbag. Yeah, absolutely. Is what it is. But that's all of this class that views themselves as the producers, as the intelligentsia, as the important ones. The Elon Musks, if you will, who see themselves as so much smarter because they've had stories written about how smart they are, and they paid for them. But it's like anything, you got a good PR firm, you're gonna look good. But this is one of these moments, and I'm standing with these workers, because the reality is, when they do better, everyone else does. And this the wife going on, well, if you don't like it, you can go find another job. You hear this frame a lot from the wealthy. And the reality is if all of the jobs are identically the same, if everyone's being treated as poorly as these workers have been, because you listen to some of the people in all of these places where this guy has places, has employees, they're kind of treated the exact same, poorly. And this is where, as I've always said, you organize, you stand up, you speak out, you fight back. And even if you're going to leave, and even if you're going to be a short timer, you leave something better behind. You create a positive environment. You make conditions better. That's the kind of the American ideal, isn't it? None of this cut and run nonsense, which is what they want you to be. Well, you don't like it, you just go somewhere else. No, if I don't like it, I'm going to stand right here and I'm going to fight to make it better. I don't like it, I'm going to stand here and I'm going to organize with all of my coworkers and we're going to make it better, which is what's going on. So for my friends in Pittsburgh, please, this holiday season, stand with the workers there at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Go down to the picket line, walk with them, bring them coffee and help give them the energy to stick this out one day longer. December 6th, as he said, is their next bargaining session, which, again, for me, way too long down the road. They should be in bargaining every single day because people's lives, people's families' lives are on the line here. But you know what? That's what the owners want. They want to starve them out. They want to make it look like, oh, we're trying, while simultaneously starving these people. Which is why we've got to help them out. And the hope is you go to cwa.org/ppg-donate and throw a couple bucks their way. Again, we're going to be off through the holiday season. I hope you and your family and friends the best of holiday seasons, best memories, all of that stuff, and good and healthy food as well. Try not to overindulge. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. But we'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Spring is here, making it the perfect time for outdoor projects. Suncast storage sheds are an excellent solution for protecting outdoor lawn and gardening tools. They're easy to assemble, and the all-weather construction provides water resistance and UV protection. Save big on Suncast storage sheds. View our selection of Suncast products today in-store and on Menards.com. Save big.